Perhaps you've heard of the Fediverse. It's a term being thrown around now, associated with platforms like Mastodon, Flipboard, ActivityPub, and Threads, among others. And before you roll your eyes at something that sounds like metaverse, I want to assure you, even though the technology may sound complex, the reality is the Fediverse and what it stands for is practical, and it's actually something that people have wanted for a long time. Let's let Mike McHugh, the CEO of Flipboard, explain it.
It's just like building a website, right? You can build a website and you can have really great things on your website, and people can keep coming back to you if they discover your site and keep looking at that content. You can put whatever you want on there whenever you want. You can monetize it however you want. You can put a paywall on there. You can put advertising on there. You could have a Patreon model, whatever you want to do, or you can make it completely free. It's up to you as a creator. And that freedom to post whatever you want, whenever you want, monetize it however you want, to an audience that is your audience that you can always reliably reach, is what the social web promises. And that is like a game changer for ultimately, I believe, how journalism works, where media companies will go, the creator economy. It is a very, very promising new world.
The portability of your profile, content, and audience sounds amazing. And Mike McHugh is leading Flipboard through this transition. What does it mean for consumers, and why is that important? That's what Mike is going to help us learn. This is Timeless Leadership, where we explore the values and principles that drive extraordinary leaders. We look for the timeless virtues that are just as relevant in the 21st century as they were in the first century. Universal truths that will help make us better versions of ourselves. Hi, and welcome to Timeless Leadership. I'm Scott Monty. I'm a former executive at Ford Motor Company and now an executive coach and speaker. I am so glad that you are here and investing time in yourself to learn some timeless lessons today. And that's what it's all about, learning. And you can do that regularly with the Timeless and Timely newsletter, which is available on Substack. It would be my honor to welcome you there and to help you learn with me on this marvelous journey that is leadership. I'm learning more every single day, and a lot of it comes from reading. And I hope you'll take me up on the offer to read the Timeless and Timely newsletter to help you on your journey. And I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform makes sense for you and give us a good rating. I'm particularly fond of Good Pods, who has ranked Timeless Leadership in the top 50 of its management podcasts. I'll have a link in the show notes to that. One of the exciting things about living in the era that we do is that we get to witness technology change at an accelerated pace. And just as I was on the front line to experience and lead some of the change happening at Ford Motor Company through social media, we're now in the midst of even greater change with AI and now the Fediverse. If you, as a leader, are concerned about what lies ahead, or finding yourself feeling unmoored in a sea of uncertainty, this episode is for you. And we should chat. In my executive coaching, I help leaders perform better in this kind of ever-changing environment and then prepare for the inevitable future. But let's hear what Mike has to say about the future in this episode. From a young age, Mike McHugh was fascinated by the creative power of software and began his first business in high school, writing video games at home that he licensed to magazines and game publishers like Quarterdeck. He had wanted to be an astronaut, and his first real app was a space shuttle flight simulator. staying close to home, Mike started his first company, Paper Software, in Woodstock, New York. His mission? To make technology as easy to use as a piece of paper. Paper built the first browser plugin and ultimately was acquired by Netscape, bringing Mike and his team to Silicon Valley in 1996. The common thread throughout his career is making information more accessible, which led Mike to co-found Telme Networks after he left Netscape. Telme soon became a pioneer in voice recognition software years before Apple introduced Siri. Telme caught the attention of giants like Microsoft and led to an acquisition in 2007. Not one to rest on his laurels, Mike next created Flipboard, the world's first social magazine, which combines human curation with AI-driven personalization to bring the best stories together into one beautiful experience. With Flipboard, Mike was determined to rethink how the web looked and felt by making it easy to discover important and inspiring stories as you flip through each page. Beyond these ventures, Mike's influence has been felt across the tech world, having served on Twitter's board of directors between 2010 and 2012, and mentoring countless tech startups. Today, he also hosts .social, a podcast about the future of social media and the importance of open standards as an agent of change that will reshape the next generation of the web, much like it did when he was at Netscape. Mike McHugh, welcome to Timeless Leadership.
It's so good to be here, Scott.
Boy, you and I have known each other for, gosh, a decade and a half or so, I gotta say. But
yeah,
you have been around the tech space for a while, as we just heard there with your bio. For people who may be, let's say, newer to the internet than you and I, what was Netscape?
Oh, man, I've reached the age where people have to ask that question, huh? Well,
and how did you get there?
For all of those who may not know, Netscape was the first mainstream internet company, a web company. It was the company that really popularized the web browser, the concept of a web browser, and the web itself. It also built servers that you could use to build your own websites. Later they built, we built a search engine and portal that kind of began a lot of the concepts of media on the web. Netscape was a very formative company, at a very formative time. Prior to that, it was all about AOL, America Online. So if you wanted to be on the internet, or actually not on the internet, if you wanted to just be online, you signed up for AOL and, they were by far the dominant way to do that. There were a few other services like CompuServe and Prodigy. All of these services were closed, what we call in the tech industry, walled gardens, which meant that they didn't interoperate with each other. So if you were on AOL and you wanted to email somebody on CompuServe, you couldn't do that. You had to join AOL. And if you were a travel company and you wanted to be online, you had to go cut a business development deal with AOL. Otherwise, you wouldn't be online. And then the internet happened. The internet had been around for a long time in kind of academic and government use cases. But Netscape was the company that really popularized the internet, made it such that people started to build websites and discover websites, and those websites quickly surpassed what AOL was capable of doing on their own, and the web really became a mainstream phenomenon.
And here we are. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned there how AOL basically acted as a gatekeeper of sorts, and if you either didn't strike a deal with them or they just determined you didn't fit in their business model, well, you weren't part of the online experience then.
That's right.
I think even today, we still feel echoes of that and certainly through what's become known as walled gardens. And we'll get into walled gardens in a bit. But you went on, as I mentioned there in your bio, to tell me, which I was a big fan of back in the early 2000s, I guess. I still remember dialing up Tell Me on my phone and, you know, having that experience there. It was voice activated. It was kind of like a menu tree of sorts, but it was content rich. Talk a little bit about that, because I think this is really kind of planting the seeds for, you know, the content curation that we see through Flipboard.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, Tell Me was a voice browser. It let you basically browse the internet using your voice. So you say what you want and you get it. So you could say the Yankees and it'll tell you the Yankees score. And it would tell you, by the way, in a way that's even better than like Siri or Alexa today, it would tell you the Yankees score with some emotion. It would be like, the Yankees crushed the Red Sox, you know, 15-2.
You're killing me. I'm a Red Sox fan, Mike.
Oh, okay. Well, we go the other way around then.
I know you're from New York originally, so I can That's forgive right. you for that.
But my son, he's a Red Sox fan, so yeah. But we wanted to build basically a way of navigating the web using nothing but your voice. And so this was the forerunner to Alexa, to Siri, services that we know well today. And, you know, it was built at a time when there was no such thing as a mobile phone that you could download an app to or anything like that. There was no iPhone. So you had to call an 800 number to access it. So yeah. You'd call 1-800-555-TELL and then just say whatever you want. And we'd go browse the internet and give it back to you. And importantly, we did that using an open standard called Voice XML. So it's they can think of that as like HTML, but for voice. Interestingly, Alexa, Siri, these are walled gardens today. Our vision was to really do something that was open and interoperable. Unfortunately, you know, the walled gardens kind of won out there. Siri and Alexa are the kind of dominant voice services today. But they don't interoperate with each other. You know, you can't just write one experience, you know, that works on both of those things. You have to go do business development deals with each of those companies if you want your services integrated, right? So I think that, like, you know, a theme of a lot of the work that I've done in the past has been, you know, making information and content on the internet accessible to people. And open standards is a fundamental way of doing that. And interoperability is a core goal of mine. You know, so in some ways, the Tell Me mission, while it was certainly great and successful in a lot of different ways, it wasn't successful in actually creating an interoperable world where these voice services could just work together. No, you know, maybe one day we'll get there, but that was what Tell Me was all about. And now we're, you know, I've moved on to a different kind of browser, a social browser.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, obviously this is like pre 2007. So it was before the iPhone, right? When, you know, the flip phone was still a thing. So
that's right.
Made a lot of sense given that kind of infrastructure in which to work. But, you know, I just as an aside, I remember one of the fun things I loved to do with Tell Me was play blackjack.
Oh yeah.
And you got somebody to do a Sean Connery impersonation.
Right. We did. it was awesome.
I still remember that. You lose.
Wow, you're very good at this. That's excellent.
Well, you know, maybe I missed my calling. What can I say?
Well, you have a perfect voice for Tell Me too. You know, we looked for different voice talents, and you know, I was not familiar with that world until we started Tell Me, and it was so fun. You know, auditioning and recruiting all these different voice talents so that every app had its own unique sort of personality. And again, that's something you don't see in Siri yet. You don't see that in Alexa, right? It's always the same person. It's always that same kind of weirdly robotic voice. And, you know, I actually think, you know, we developed a lot of really cool technology to allow these, like, around any voice talent to be, have words fused together in a way that sounded completely natural.
Right.
So it sounded like they actually said, you know, the Yankees or the Red Sox crushed the Yankees. Right. Like, but it wasn't, it was a technology that we helped create called co-articulation, where you could actually fuse different words together based on the type of, you know, the beginning of each word so that it sounded totally smooth. Anyway, that's something I would love to see happen with Siri and Alexa as well, right? These different voice personalities.
That would be amazing. Really would. So that brings us to Flipboard. And, you know, I've been a huge advocate of Flipboard since the earliest days. And I guess the way I would describe it to most people as a shorthand is it is an app-based magazine. And it's one where you can build your own magazines. You can browse topics that are relevant or meaningful to you. You can find other creators. You can even share interests with other people and build things together. And one of the things that I've loved watching your leadership at Flipboard is how you've been aware, hyper aware, I think, of the negative aspects of social media, some of the detriments from a societal and behavioral perspective, I think, and how you've gone out of your way to give people that personalized experience, much like you did with Tell Me, but you did so in a way that almost looked out for their well-being. Can you talk a little bit about the vision behind Flipboard?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for saying that. I think, you know, Flipboard is not just my latest startup. I've done one startup every 10 years for the last, you know, 3 or 4 decades. It's my favorite. And the reason why I say that, it is the culmination of a lot of the work that I've done and a lot of the things that I've learned working with some amazing people over many years, during the formation of mobile, formation of the internet, it's really, and social media. And so I think that, I see the power of social media, as being, something that is, really important for the world. You know, it's one thing to see an article about climate change on the internet. It's an entirely other thing to see that this is an article that Al Gore thinks is the most important article to read this year about climate change, right? There's so much content on the internet that you really need people who know what they're talking about to endorse good content to help it be discovered. Content that isn't discovered goes to waste. And sometimes that content's not worth discovering. There's more junk on the internet than there is good stuff, right? And so what the way to find the good stuff, which is increasingly difficult to find, by the way, with AI, with the way SEO is hardwired, the way monetization works, I mean, just the fact that the content's even created and it's good is almost a miracle these days, because it's really, really hard to monetize that content, to make that a sustainable operation. So what I believe is that the web has been missing for a long time a critical component, and that is people. The web is right now, and was in its inception, effectively a link between one document and another document and another document, you know, on the internet in an open standard written using HTML and connected using HTTP. And this sort of web of documents is amazing. It's created, you know, trillions of dollars in value. It overthrew AOL, but it doesn't have people in that web. You don't have links to people. You don't have people linking to documents. You don't have that whole social element, the whole social graph, which is essential for discovery, for interacting with other communities that you care about, is completely missing. And instead, it's locked away in a variety of walled gardens that we know well today. And that's a huge, huge downside. And because these walled gardens own the connection between people, many, many, many bad things have happened with social media that don't have to happen, Social media is, like I said, incredibly important for content discovery, for connection, for communicating with others. But it has been massively abused. It's been distorted. It's been absconded and taken over by, you know, lots of bad actors, such that now it's really, really hard to get a good, high quality social media experience. So I think, you know, with Flipboard, coming back to, you know, why did we start Flipboard? We saw the web evolving with mobile, and we also saw social as this critical new component of how the web would work, how you would discover on the web. And so what we created was what we call a social magazine. That's Flipboard. It's like, it's in some ways just another great web browser. It's like reimagining a web browser, but with an important critical component, which is the social component, where people are recommending. People are the editors of the magazine. People who know what they're talking about. People who understand and have insight into key topics and areas. So what we did is we integrated Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram and all sorts of other social services into Flipboard, so that everything you saw on Flipboard came from people who were endorsing that content. And as we know, those services eventually shut down their APIs one by one. And so we had to basically build our own walled garden, our own social layer, which allows people to curate content into magazines. So, you know, I love your magazines on Flipboard. You know, I trust you as a curator. I rely on you to help me discover really great content about leadership, for example. And that's an example of social media working really well. Now, that said, we're a walled garden too. You know, what we really want to do is take that social layer that we've built and basically transform it by opening it up and making it part of the broader emerging social web, which some people refer to as the Fediverse.
Yeah, and we're seeing more of this discussion happening now. I remember, you know, kind of being disheartened and disillusioned a bit when Instagram turned off its access to external, you know, its API access to external platforms. So, you know, the great photographs I was finding on Instagram, I could no longer flip into my magazines. And, you know, speaking of expert curators, Mike, I know one of your passions is photography. And I know I can always count on some breathtaking stuff when I go to your magazine. Yeah. But that wasn't coming through any Instagram feeds. And then last year, Twitter shut down as well. And this is a pipeline into so many things. And I think this notion of being a curator for people, it's a service. You know, you're taking your expertise, you're providing a lens, and then you're serving it up to people in a way that saves them time, saves them having to look around. And the added bonus there is that you're a trusted expert in that field. So, you know, I think it was just perfect the way you kind of aligned all of these things. And now, with you know, Twitter shutting down for much of the world, you know, it's complete API access. It's turned off a lot of people. And there's other reasons Twitter's turned off a lot of people as well.
That's
we don't need to get into all that. But people turned to Mastodon, and they're turning to Threads now. And I noticed Threads just recently announced that they are going to federate their content, which basically means open it up to the external world. Can you talk about some of the trends you're seeing there and how you're trying to fit into that and make whatever it is that comes next here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're absolutely right. Threads, ironically, the Instagram team, which previously had shut down their API, you know, created Threads as a competitor to Twitter. And they have made it a strategic priority to federate, which means that it will be an open social experience on the social web in the Fediverse. And so this is a big development because they're such a large player. And it's a testament to the fact that the concepts around the social web, the first principles that underlie how the social web has been developing over the last few years are very, very timely right now and very important to uphold and to make happen. So, you know, the work that Eugene Rochko has done, who created Mastodon almost single-handedly, is really quite a thing to see. He has almost single-handedly made the Fediverse like a reality for people. You know, there are other people as well who've been building other services in the Fediverse, like there's PixelFed, there's Kbin, which is sort of, PixelFed's kind of like an open version of Instagram. There's PeerTube, which is sort of like an open version of YouTube. There's Kbin, which is like an open version of Reddit. And these are great services, but they're all still very small scale right now. So to have a large player like Meta come in, with the entire Instagram social graph, you know, that could end up being, which is, you know, how, when you onboard to Threads, you bring your social graph, from Instagram with you. And that social graph is about to become part of the social web over the course of the next year or so. And that is a very big deal, because what we're all witnessing right now really is, the social web, which has been around for a few years, really becoming much more mainstream. It's not really mainstream yet, but I think by the end of this year or so, it will be.
Wow. Exciting times ahead then. So
yeah,
what do you see as some potential as the social web continues to gain traction, and where do you think of Flipboard and the rest of the communities kind of fit in here?
Well, I think nobody really knows for sure how this is all going to play out, which is really cool. It reminds me of the early days of the web, when really nobody knew how the web was going to play out, right? What's this going to be like? What are these experiences going to be? How's monetization going to work? We didn't really know the answers to those questions. And I think we're in that same situation now. Now, to kind of project to the best of our ability now, what are things going to be like? What's this all going to mean? I think it's important to understand really just some of those core first principles that form the basis of the social web. So one of those is interoperability, right? So the idea that, I would join a social network and I'd have to go and figure out who to follow and build a whole new following list there and get people to follow me now over on this other new social network, right? All of that sort of startup time to like get up to speed, that goes away. When any new social service that you want to use, let's say it's an app that records you on a bike, you know, and your biking trail or your biking progress, right? And you want to share that with some friends socially. Well, you can just share that on the social web. You don't have to create a whole new, you know, account and a whole new social identity and a whole new profile and a whole new, you know, set of followers and following, right? What that means is that there's no longer a moat for innovation, right? Today, if you're a developer and you have a really cool new idea for how social media should work, well, good luck getting anyone to fund that. Good luck getting anyone to adopt it if you have to have all these people who join it create a profile, you know, put their bio in, get followers, get people to follow them, get, you know, figure out who to follow, right? Like, it's way too much of a hurdle. And this is why the existing social networks that are out there just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Because they have this huge moat, right? So the interoperability is huge. The other thing, other first principle that is absolutely massive is the concept of owning your own social graph. So what this means is that if I'm a creator, right, and I have a lot of people who follow me, I can use any service to create content and get it to my followers. I could post video on PeerTube. I could post images on PixelFed. I could write blog posts on Medium. But those, because these services increasingly are using ActivityPub, the followers that I have basically see all that content no matter where I'm posting it from. And that means that I'm no longer tied to a particular social platform. So if one of these social platforms just goes away, or the CEO goes crazy and, you know, changes it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Mike.
Exactly. Something like that could happen. I mean, and so hypothetically, you don't, as a creator, have to kind of leave that platform and build a whole new audience somewhere else. You're not locked in, right? And because you own your audience, and that direct relationship with someone who cares about you and your content or what you have to say or what you're curating, that direct relationship is absolutely fundamental, and it will change everything. Because if you think about it, today, those relationships are principally owned by other companies. Yeah. And you as a creator have to sort of like do what those other companies say you need to do to reach your own audience.
Yeah.
And that's insane, right? That's ridiculous. And that, so now the opportunity to have a direct relationship with your audience means that as a creator, as a journalist, as a writer, as a video maker, or just even as a curator, because you're right, curation is a service, you can actually build a sustainable, viable living out of that. And no one can take that away from you. It's just like building a website, right? You can build a website and you can have really great things on your website, and people can keep coming back to you if they discover your site and keep looking at that content. You can put whatever you want on there whenever you want. You can monetize it however you want. You can put a paywall on there. You can put advertising on there. You could have a Patreon model, whatever you want to do, or you can make it completely free. It's up to you as a creator. And that freedom to post whatever you want, whenever you want, monetize it however you want to an audience that is your audience that you can always reliably reach is what the social web promises. And that is like a game changer for ultimately, I believe, how journalism works, where media companies will go, the creator economy. It is a very, very promising new world.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very much in line with what we've heard for years when we talk content strategy. We say don't build your content on other people's property. The notion being that, you know, ultimately you should control your audience, your content, et cetera. And
right.
You know, if something goes sideways with a platform, then good luck to you. And to me, the email list has been king, mm-hmm. and still is.
That's
in
right.
2024. And I think that's why models like Substack are doing so well, is because they're so flexible and you can port your content and your audience in or out if you need to.
Yeah.
And that's never been the case with social. And I've seen people struggling, particularly with what's been going on at Twitter and, you know, like ethically having problems with the way it's run. But particularly on the journalism side, because they've built up such an audience there, they're hesitant to leave because it would mean leaving behind this audience and having to build from scratch elsewhere. So there are ethical implications in not having that that portability, the owning your audience and taking them with you. And I think this, with what's going on with the Fediverse, kind of answers that ethical quandary.
It does. I 100% agree with you. And, you know, people don't have to just decide to leave Twitter and join Mastodon. You can stay on Twitter. But over time, direct more and more of your audience to, let's say, Mastodon, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I think it's important for people to understand is that, you know, if you're a creator on YouTube and you're posting your videos there, great. You know, you have an audience, you have subscribers. I don't think nobody needs to walk away from that. You know, that's just not pragmatic. But if you also build presence in the Fediverse where you're posting your videos, and over time getting more and more of your audience to follow you there, right? Then over time, you are going to be now in control of your own audience, and YouTube will matter less and less unless YouTube ultimately federates too, which I think could very well happen. As enough momentum builds around the concept of the Fediverse, what I think you'll see is that some platforms will actually adopt it and they will federate too, because this is just a fundamentally better model. It will take time. And I'm talking, you know, that's 2, 3, 4 years down the road, I believe. But as a creator, you know, you don't have to abandon all these other platforms. You can still use them, but use them as a way to now direct people to your Fediverse presence.
Yeah.
And use that, like we do with, you know, newsletters is a good example, right? We try to get people to sign up for your newsletter. Now, you know, you have your email address, as we know, newsletters aren't particularly, they're also challenged because, you know, the way email works has been more and more problematic over time. And it's not a perfect situation. You also have to go into your email client to see stuff. And increasingly my email client is a disaster. You know, when I go into my inbox, it's just way too much stuff. So the beauty of the social web is it creates that same kind of connection, but it does it in a more sort of feed model, right? So I go into my feed, I see all the people I'm following, you know, I can filter it, you know, increasingly there'll be third parties that build all sorts of cool ways to like filter and organize your various feeds. And so it'll be much more efficient than using email. So it's a really key moment now for creators. Like I really encourage people, if you're a creator, go figure out a way to build a presence in the Fediverse. You know, you could do that by, you know, taking your Threads account and federating that when they make that option available. That's one option. You could do it by creating a Flipboard account right now and we'll federate that for you. You could do that by just joining Mastodon. There's lots of ways to join the Fediverse, right? In fact, you might even have multiple accounts in the Fediverse. But the thing is that what you want to do increasingly as a creator is like build that presence and get people to follow you there. Get your people on YouTube or on Twitter or, you know, in Substack or other platforms to follow you there, and you won't regret it. It'll be, you know, especially now because people in the Fediverse are looking for great creators to join. So the people who come in early are going to be the ones that actually get a lot more traction. Eventually everyone will be in, so it won't be as unique or as interesting, right? I think it's a really key moment now for creators.
Yeah. And I want to turn to brands for a moment because brands have become an integral part of how social media works. I'm guilty from having worked on that side in the early days myself. And I know, you know, advertising is a particularly important part of Flipboard and your relationship with, content houses, content factories within brands and how they present their content. But in my experience, brands have always relied on the lowest common denominator, which is simply to show up on a platform, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and simply buy their way onto the feed, the way they have with television advertising and radio advertising before that and on and on. And there's been less interest by brands in participating in the social aspect of social media. They usually put the accent on media rather than on social.
Right.
And earlier you mentioned how the web has been missing people. Talk to me a little bit about how you see brands extending their presence into the Fediverse and how they can do it without necessarily, how shall I put this? As the Sum eCards site always said, let's ruin something with advertising. How can we avoid that?
Well, you know, this is something I'm very passionate about. My mom and my dad started their own small ad agency. And I remember my bedroom was right next to my dad's office. So my dad would be working late into the night on a bunch of the creative for a particular brand that he was doing a campaign for. My mom was the copywriter and the PR person. So it's in my blood. And I actually, you know, I very much appreciate great advertising. Great advertising is culturally significant. It's fantastic when it works. And I absolutely abhor bad advertising. Bad advertising isn't just bad ads. It's advertising that tracks you, violates your privacy, interrupts you, gets in the way, does everything it can to basically disrupt you, that's bad advertising. And unfortunately, that's the advertising that has really become kind of the dominant form of advertising on the internet. But it doesn't need to be that way. And I think that you mentioned the social web, you know, it's about people and their connections, right? To content, to sources, to brands. Brands are a big reason why the brand advertising model works the way it does on the internet, is because there was never really this concept of a direct relationship between a user and a brand. So everything I said earlier about creators applies to brands as well. You as a brand stand for something, right? If you're a good brand, right? Everything I'm about to say applies to quality brands that people actually like and good products. You know, if you're a scam, none of this is actually going to work. And that's the beauty here. But for quality brands, let's take Leica as an example. I love landscape photography and I love my Leica camera and I love Leica as a brand. And they make fantastic content, great video about people using their cameras. They have amazing photographs that they feature from people who are using their cameras. They talk about how to take great photos. They have, you know, fantastic seminars or webinars that they have. So they're a brand that has something to say, a brand that people, you know, really care about. And so right now, though, they don't have that direct relationship with me. I follow them on Twitter, but that doesn't really get me much in my For You feed. You know, I only see posts from Elon and other crazy people, and I don't see anything from Leica, right? Even though I follow them. So Leica has to pay to be seen on Twitter, which is really unfortunate. And so if you think back to the way magazines used to work, or do work still, you open up a magazine about photography, and guess what? You're going to see a beautiful ad from Leica, another ad from Nikon, also ads from much smaller advertisers, you know, small little startups that have made some really cool tripod or cool new camera bag. And that's all makes sense because I'm reading about photography, and the ads are just as much of the experience as the content itself, right? As long as it's not overdone. And there's typically a ratio there that magazines have found where, you know, there's quality content that's been organized and structured, paired up with really high quality, relevant advertising. None of those ads had to track me down. None of those ads had to violate my privacy. None of those ads had to like pop in front of me while I was reading an article. They're just there, and I notice them and appreciate them. And so I believe advertising can work like that on the internet. There's no reason why I can't. The key thing, though, is that once you enable a brand to gain a direct connection with me, so if Leica can have a direct connection with me, because I follow Leica on the Fediverse, and by the way, they are on the Fediverse. We federated them. They're one of our advertisers, so you can actually follow them now in the Fediverse. Leica now knows that I'm following them. They have a direct relationship with me. And as they post content, I can see it. I can comment back to it. They can comment back to me. That's amazing. And they don't have to pay anyone to make sure that I see that content, right? So that's what we're getting to. And I think it's going to completely disrupt in a good way how the digital ad model works online, and how, as a result of that, how content services and digital media works because of that direct relationship.
Well, I, for one, applaud your optimism, and I am cheering from the side, just like you are. So, and it's interesting. A few episodes ago, I had Lou Pascalis on, and we talked about
Lou's awesome.
Isn't he? We talked about advertising's ethical responsibility to support mm-hmm. journalism, and you know, I know that's Lou's kind of torch right now, and you know, listening to you talking about what brands could or should or ought to do in the Fediverse, you know, I see some wonderful parallels there. And I think there's reason for lots of optimism looking forward.
I agree with you. I loved that episode with you and Lou. I thought it was really very prescient. And after that episode, I actually had dinner with Lou a couple weeks ago in New York.
Huh.
And we talked a lot of, we talked a lot about this. And I introduced him to a lot of what we're doing and in the Fediverse, and he was incredibly excited. So it is, I think, this kind of magical time where some of the people who've been really believers in social media, believers in digital advertising, but have been seeing all the challenges, you know, over the last 10 years, certainly accelerating. There's a moment of optimism and hopefulness now that we can actually reform a lot of this for the betterment of everybody, users, creators, publishers, and brands.
Yeah. And, you know, in many ways, it feels like that optimism of the early Web 2.0 and early social media evolution where, you know, we saw so much potential there. Of course, now I think what we have is the good and the bad of the experience of the last 15, 20 years behind us. And hopefully that will cause us to be a little more thoughtful about how we go ahead and build some of these things. And that's why we need people like you, Mike, who are leading us forward. So where can people find you if they want to find out more about what you're doing, what you're up to?
Well, you can certainly find me on Flipboard. I'm Mike M at flipboard.com. You can follow me there. You can also find me on Mastodon. So I'm Mike at flipboard.social there. Those are two of probably the best places to see what I'm working on and talking about.
And of course, people can listen to your new podcast, Dot Social, an entirely appropriate title, given your Mastodon address there. So
yes, I'm excited about, being learning to be a creator. And, you know, a podcaster has been really fun and also very helpful as I'm working to build products to help podcasters and other creators.
That's fantastic. Well, Mike, thanks so much for being with us here on Timeless Leadership.
Thank you, Scott. It was fantastic to talk to you.
How great that a leader like Mike embraces learning as he helps to continually improve how and where we go about creating, sharing, and curating content across the social web. You know, leadership is a journey of learning and discovery, whether you're helping others learn or you're learning yourself. And ultimately, when you inspire others to learn more, dream more, do more, and become more, you are a timeless leader. I'm Scott Monty. There's so much to learn.